Blog Talk Radio.
Ken Hudnall, this is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, we've been talking about unsolved mysteries, and I've got one tonight that though people have tried and tried and tried, they've not been able to solve. It all began Nuremberg, Bavaria, May 26, 1828. It was Whitman Day, and most of the citizens had gone to the German holiday ritual, the Ausflug. Hardly a soul in sight when an enigmatic-looking creature came hobbling down the hill leading to Unslit Square. On normal days, he would have attracted plenty of attention. He was dressed like a scarecrow and moved with a curiously stiff-legged lurch as if his feet had gone to sleep. The only other person in the vicinity who saw him was a local cobbler named George Wackman. He saw the stranger, a well-built young boy in his middle teens, and stopped to look at him closer. When the boy saw him, he approached him and mumbled a few words that the cobbler couldn't understand and held out an envelope he was carrying. It was addressed to the Captain of the 4th Squadron, 6th Cavalry Regiment, Nuremberg. Now, the nearest military post was the Newgate Guardroom, and Wackman took the boy over there and handed him over to the sergeant in charge. Still wasn't sure if the lurching, mumbling, ragged young man was drunk or sick. The sergeant, in his turn, directed the boy to the house of the 4th Squadron captain, whose name was Wessenig. Now, the officer was out, but his servants told the boy he could wait with his letter till Hauptmann, it's German for the captain, returned. When Wessenig returned home several hours later, he found his household just buzzing with excitement. The boy had appeared to try to pick up the flame of a candle with his fingers and had screamed with astonishment when he got burned. Offered some ham and a mug of beer, he reacted as if he'd never seen such things before. But he greedily drank water and wolfed black bread with every sign of a roaring appetite. But he wouldn't touch the beer and he wouldn't touch the ham. Answered any questions put to him either with incoherent mumbling or a constantly repeated, "Weissnick, don't know." And what's more, he was visibly frightened by a grandfather clock that he seemed to think was a living thing. When the smell of cooking drifted in from the kitchen, he gagged as if it made him ill. Now, after listening to this account from his servant, so Eisenhower opened the envelope addressed to him, and it contained two notes. The first one said, "Honored Captain, I send you a lad who wishes to serve as king in the army. He was brought to me on October 7th, 1812. I'm but a poor laborer with children of my own to rear. His mother asked me to bring up the boy, so I thought I'd rear him as my own son. Since then, I've never let him go one step outside the house, so no one knows where he was reared. He himself doesn't know the name of the place or where it's at. You can question him, honored captain, but he'll not be able to tell you where I live. I brought him out at night. He can't find his way back. Hadn't got a penny, for I have nothing myself. If you won't keep him, you must strike him dead or hang him." Now, this curious note, described as badly spelled and clumsily phrased, was neither dated or signed. The second note, dated October 12th, 1812, said, "The child has been baptized. His name is Casper. You must give him a second name yourself. I ask you to take care of him. His father was a cavalry soldier. When he's 17, take him to Nuremberg to the 6th Cavalry Regiment. His father belonged to it. I beg you to keep him till he's 17. He was born April 30th, 1812. I'm a poor girl. I can't take care of him. His father's dead." Well, the subject of the two letters, Casper, as he was named, livened up considerably in the presence of the captain. Several times he said very clearly, "I want to be a soldier like my father." And horse, horse. He also stroked the officer's saber in its scabbard with shouts of glee. Well, Weisnig could make nothing of either the letters or the boy himself, who he said appeared to be either a primitive savage or an imbecile. So he had the young man taken to the police station. First thing the police did was give the boy a pencil and paper and ask him to write down his name and address. He legibly wrote down Casper Hauser, but nothing else. When they asked him for his address, he said, "I don't know." Next step was to strip and search the young man. This was done by Wachtmeister, the sergeant, Jim Wust, to whom we owe the first and probably most accurate description of this walking riddle. According to the sergeant, Casper Hauser was a sturdy, broad-shouldered young man of about 17 years with a healthy complexion, light brown hair, blue eyes, small hands and feet. Because of his clumsy gait, he was first thought to be crippled, but closer inspection showed there was nothing wrong with him. He merely had exceptionally tender soles that are badly blistered from unaccustomed walking. The clothes he wore clearly didn't belong to him. The old hat and tattered shirt were too large. His boots were too tight. His trousers and jacket had been made for some adult of considerably greater girth. His pockets contained only a rosary, a couple of printed religious tracts, and a packet of salt. Nothing on him could provide the faintest clue to his identity. There was nothing except those two letters. Well, it didn't take the police long to recognize them as fakes. They were written in different scripts, the first in the stilted Gothic lettering taught only in German schools, the second in the generally known Latin style. They supposed to have been written by a man and a woman about 16 years apart, but both handwritings are quite similar. The type of paper was exactly the same, and the ink equally fresh on both of them. So the letters had clearly been written very recently and by the same person who obviously was trying to draw a red herring across the boy's background. Casper's own handwriting was matched against the notes, but his scrawl was too childish to do any good. Removed from the military stimulation of the captain, Casper became quickly withdrawn again. He seemed grateful when his host locked him in a cell for further observation. The observing, of course, was done by a veteran turnkey named Patel, who had watched legions of inmates and was struck by the boy's unusual reaction to confinement. He reported he can sit for hours without moving a limb. He doesn't pace the floor, doesn't try to sleep, sits rigidly without growing in the least uncomfortable. He prefers darkness to light and can move about it like a cat. Well, despite such intriguing observations, the police made no progress with their charge. At each interrogation, he repeated his desire to become a writer, a cavalryman like his father. Otherwise, he stuck to his know-nothing formula. As to his phony letters, no one had the vaguest notion as who might have written them or even why. But meanwhile, the people of Nuremberg had become interested in this odd newcomer. They arrived in droves to watch the nature child devour hunks of rye bread, still refused to touch any other type of food, and the smell of meat cooking made him physically ill. He'd write his only words, Caspar Hauser, on any piece of paper given to him. And his reaction to the most ordinary items were those of a baby. He would spend hours listening to a ticking watch. He'd grab a knife by the blade. He'd gaze in wonder at the figures on playing cards. He'd build houses with coins. What was even more amusing, he apparently didn't know the difference between the sexes. Used the same term, Junge, boy, for both men and women. One of his all-embracing words was horse, which he applied to all animals. Horses, though, seemed to fascinate him, and he really came out of his shell when a visitor brought him a wooden one. He'd adorn the toy with ribbons, conscientiously feed it every time he ate, and he'd play with his wooden horse with great interest, exactly as a normal child might play with a toy horse. Equally infantile was his ignorance concerning the passage of time. Didn't know the meaning of hours and minutes, days and nights. Finally, and this caused the visitors much delighted titillation, he had no sense of physical shame. He'd perform his natural functions in front of a mixed audience, ignoring them completely. For present standards, the idea of turning a cell occupant into a public freak show seems quite revolting, but in 1828, this was still the era of public executions, of guided tours through lunatic asylums, and of the public flogging of prostitutes and army deserters. Far from being upset by the attention, Caspar seemed to enjoy the attention he received from the crowds. Well, now began the process of turning him from an oddity into a national figure. He began to learn with amazing rapidity all the things most individuals acquire in the course of a decade or more. His vocabulary grew from a few words to fluent phraseology. His reading and writing prowess reached approximately fifth grade level. His ability to handle utensils like scissors, matches, quills, and lanterns increased to that of an ordinary adult. All of which indicated the boy, far from being mentally retarded, had somehow been prevented from learning the most elementary skills up to this stage of life. The question, of course, was who prevented him and why would they have done such a thing? We don't know precisely how long after his arrival Caspar Hauser had acquired speech sufficiently coherent for him to tell his own story. The first personal record was issued in the form of a bulletin signed by Burgomaster Binder of Nuremberg and the members of the town council, dated July 7th, just about 6 weeks after the boy's appearance. His first statement was later supplemented dozens of times by Caspar himself. According to what the young man said, for as long as he could remember, he lived in a kind of cell about 7 feet long, 4 feet wide, and 5 feet high. The windows were boarded. The floor was bare earth with a bundle of straw on which he could lie back when sleeping. When awake, he would sit. There was no room for him to stand upright or to walk. When he woke up, he always found a loaf of dark bread and a jug of water by his side. Certain intervals, the water would have a strange, bitter taste, and he'd go to sleep. When awakening, his clothes and straw would have been changed, and his nails and hair were cut. The only other objects in his cell, he said, were three wooden toy horses. He wasn't aware of being either unhappy or lonely. He simply didn't know any other form of existence. Nor had he known of the existence of any other beings. He accepted his food just as he accepted his toys as something that just was, like sleep or hunger. He couldn't recall hearing any outside sounds, nor experiencing any change of temperature or any change of lighting. Had no way of telling how long he stayed in that cell since he had no concept of time. But one day, a man entered the room and placed a board over his knees, showed him how to hold a pencil, gave him a sheet of paper, and very slowly and patiently taught him to write the name Caspar Hauser in block letters. Over a period of time, this same man also made him repeat certain phrases and words like want to be a soldier, horse, and don't know. These phrases were Caspar's entire original vocabulary. The only painful incident in his early life occurred when he'd been playing more noisily than usual with his horses, and the man came in and struck him on the arm with a stick. Shortly after this, Caspar awoke from one of his deep sleeps to find his clothes had been changed, and he was wearing boots. The man entered again, but this time led him out of his prison, upward and into the open air. The boy felt so dizzy and confused by the completely new experience, he only had a dimmest recollection of the the journey. He said they walked. His feet hurt. Man talked to him, promising him a big live horse after you become a soldier. And then the next thing he knew, he was alone, walking painfully through one of the gates in Nuremberg. He couldn't remember being given the letters he carried or any detail about the road they took or anything about the man's looks or build beyond the impression he was big and strong. Well, the story, of course, created a sensation. Nuremberg went haywire with excitement. Conversations over beer mugs and coffee cups dealt with hardly anything else. As the local wit, Friedelin Leitner, put it, you'd think every woman in town had given birth to Caspar Hauser and that every man had fathered him. Well, Nuremberg had reason to make the most of its fantastic foundling. This was the age of the Biedermeister in Germany, the era of stifling pre-Victorian stuffiness that followed the prolonged turmoil of the Napoleonic Wars. This was the time in which the nation was threatened to be smothered beneath an elderdown of bourgeois respectability and political censorship. In Nuremberg, sensations of any kind were few and far between. Now, of course, architecturally, the city was a gem of medieval craftsmanship, and the town also was thoroughly provincial. All the exciting scandals seemed to be happening in the much more glamorous Bavarian capital of Munich. Nuremberg was a parched tinderbox of boredom, aching for something, any spark to relieve that boredom. Well, Caspar Hauser was the spark, and every Nuremberger set about busily fanning the flame. The burgomaster and the town council led the way. By official proclamation, Caspar Hauser was made a ward of the municipality, which henceforth would pay for his upkeep. The town press turned out thousands of handbills bearing his image, along with an appeal that anyone possessing knowledge of his true identity or any intelligence pertaining to same should come forward and inform the authorities and get a cash reward. Simultaneously, police agents were set to scour the Bavarian kingdom for his possible place of imprisonment. Well, unfortunately, all these efforts proved futile. Neither then nor in the years to come was the reward claimed, nor was any trace of the boy's jailer or his jailer ever discovered. But Nuremberg, though, happily basked in the glory of the boy's wonder. Within weeks, not merely Bavaria, but all of Germany, France, Hungary, and even England played the guessing game. Who is Caspar Hauser? What made the game so intriguing was the obvious supposition that none would have gone to such lengths to keep a lad hidden unless the boy was somebody pretty important. To guess the degree of importance and thereby to implicate some high-ranking personality was the exciting core of this pastime. If he was the illegitimate son of some duke or king or earl, oh, the scandal. A pilgrimage to Nuremberg got underway. Dozens of major and minor celebrities line up to for interviews with the foundling, some of them traveling considerable distances for the privilege. Best known among them was the illustrious German jurist and criminologist, Anselm Ritter von Feuerbach. This eminent lawyer questioned Caspar many times and examined him physically as well. In the end, he accepted the boy's account unreservedly, and he drew some pretty startling conclusions. However, he didn't make those conclusions known until more than 5 years later. In the meantime, he did nothing to counter the ever-widening spate of rumors, according to which Caspar was the illegitimate offspring of virtually every high-born rake of the period, kept out of sight by his noble parent for 16 years, and finally turned loose in the world when time had eliminated the danger of a scandal. Meanwhile, the city of Nuremberg got around to finding a suitable guardian for this famous ward. The man appointed to the task was one Professor Dahmer, local lecturer and scientist of sorts, whose chief interest lay in the field of bodily magnetism, a subject which was then enjoying a tremendous vogue. Dahmer conducted a series of magnetic experiments with his charge, the results of which are no particular interest to anybody. In the course of these tests, the professor discovered that Caspar was ambidextrous. He had a fantastically acute sense of smell that he could see amazingly well in the dark, but very badly in broad daylight, which continued to hurt his eyes. In the professor's home, Caspar was no longer on general display. In fact, he became a more exclusive figure. Accompanied by his guardian, he attended almost every event given by the town social set. He was patted, lionized, quizzed, and cooed over and coddled the way only small-town celebrities are. His features were constantly scrutinized for possible resemblance to this or that count, duchess, or earl whose offspring he might be. And even those observers who couldn't discern a likeness to anyone in particular claimed to see unmistakable nobility and high breeding in his face. From the dozens of woodcuts and lithographs and sketches made of Caspar, we know that his face was regular, fleshly, boyish, and perfectly ordinary. Which means he probably did look like half a hundred young aristocrats and just as many grossly clerks of the area and the period. Because he seemed to have responded to some Hungarian words spoken in his presence, a brand new batch of rumors immediately linked him with a score of Magyar barons whose morals anyway were worth breaking over in detail. Caspar himself responded to the furor about his person in an all-too-human fashion. There was no doubt, of course, that he thoroughly enjoyed being the center of attention, and he did his best to keep the interest alive. Thus, he was perpetually remembering further little details about his past, and although these minute details really added nothing to his story, every new tidbit made effective party talk. In the end, it became quite impossible to sort out the bones of the original story from the meat added in Casper's series of afterthoughts. The lad's rate of progress is truly astonishing. In the summer of 1829, only 15 months after his illiterate arrival, he put his story in writing. It was published in the municipality. Ostensibly, the little volume was his own work. We have no way of knowing how much assistance he got from Professor Dahmer. By then, though, the tale was too well known, had been printed and told too many times to attract much attention. Public interest in the foundling seemed on the wane when suddenly an incident made the case of Caspar Hauser flare up with an even greater intensity. On the afternoon of October 7, 1829, Caspar is found unconscious on the floor of Dahmer's cellar, bleeding from a gash in his forehead, and his shirt was torn to the waist. Taken to bed, he recovered after a short time and gave an account of what had happened. He said he'd been attacked by a man wearing dark clothes, leather gloves, and a silk mask. Now, this is one of the many inconsistencies that haunt the entire Hauser riddle. According to some contemporary accounts, he claimed his assailant wielded a knife. Other reports said it was a club. Whatever the weapon, the assailant struck Caspar with it and knocked him out. Almost immediately, people came forward who claimed that they had seen such a man that same afternoon. The difficulty was that the assailant had been seen in a great many different places, and that he grew and he shrank and he changed his hair coloring and his walk almost as many times as there were witnesses. Police combed Nuremberg, but didn't discover anybody who met the description. City authorities are now truly convinced their ward was in danger. They moved him from the professor's quarters into those of a certain Freiherr von Tuscher. The jurist von Furbach was appointed Caspar's guardian. In addition, they assigned two police constables to be his personal bodyguards, both of whom slept in a room with him. The public, though, had split into bitterly antagonistic camps. The majority insisted the assailant was the handiwork of the same highly placed persons who had kept Hauser locked up most of his life, and who now, for some unfathomable reason, were trying to do away with him altogether. But a little knot of skeptics declared just as noisily there had not been an assault at all. They said the whole business was just a stunt to attract attention. And they pointed out that it was indeed a curious kind of assailant who, alone with an unconscious victim, could inflict nothing more damaging than a cut on the forehead, a cut which they said Caspar could just as easily have inflicted on himself. Well, the controversy was still raging when yet another odd character appeared on the scene, all the way from England. Especially to meet Caspar Hauser came Lord Stanhope, one of the strangest eccentrics of the time. Stanhope had heard about the amazing Caspar and wanted to meet him in the flesh. To the Nurembergers, his visit confirmed the value of their star attraction, the prestige of a wealthy English lord being then what it was. After being removed from the house of Professor Dahmer, further difficulties never clearly explained ensued. Once, for instance, a shot was heard in Hauser's room. When the two bodyguards rushed in, they found their charge quite safe but extremely upset. He had a, explained, lost his balance while leaning out of the window. Clutching at the wall for support, he had torn down a pistol hanging there and had accidentally discharged it. Now, unless that pistol was cocked, a pistol of that period required you to pull back the hammer before pulling the trigger. This episode had an unnerving effect on Casper's host. He indicated he'd be rather glad to get him off the premises. This was followed by several changes in Casper's residence with considerable bother for the authorities. And the town feud continued to rage, showing no sign of abating, with a growing faction insisting DeBoer was merely an imposter, milking the city for a soft livelihood and following up with a series of fabricated incidents to keep the con game going. Well, Stanhope met Hauser several times over lengthy intervals, interspersed with his usual jaunts to various European courts and principalities. Each time his interest in DeBoer appeared to grow, even to the point of trying to teach him English. Each time his lordship returned to Nuremberg, he found Casper more unsettled, the quarrels raging around him more acrimonious. A number of noble Bavarian families were threatening to sue the next person who publicly saddled them with Casper's fraternity. At least one duel had been fought over the issue, several more threatened, so when Lord Stanhope surprisingly offered to take over the boy's upkeep, city fathers clutched at the opportunity to get rid of the boy. And the allegations that they were squandering public funds on a fraud. Casper remained in Nuremberg until May of 1833 when his guardian von Froebach died of a paralytic stroke. The old man was known to have been in the process of compiling a detailed legal report on his ward. The fact he hadn't published it gave rise to a new crop of rumors. One group claiming he'd been bribed not to, and the other day hadn't because he was ashamed to have been taken in by the boy. With the bickering rising to a shrill crescendo, the municipality grew weary of the living bone of contention. Lord Stanhope suggested removing Hauser, and the city fathers agreed, though not without a proper display of reluctance. The steady concern of the footloose Englishman for the German foundling seemed decidedly strange, but no stranger than some of Stanhope's other quirks. Anyway, he took Casper to the nearby Bavarian town of Osbach, where he left him in the care of a local teacher, Dr. Meyer, and under the special protection of a certain Captain Hickel, military officer temporarily working with the police. In those days of town soldiers' responsibility for city security, the dividing line between the military and the municipal police wasn't that clearly drawn. His lordship departed for other fields. Gradually, things grew quiet. Casper, Osbach, and correspondingly sleepier. The social world around the boy thinned down to an occasional tea party. Nuremberg turned to other topics of discussion. Then on December 14, 1833, the Casper Hauser saga ended as abruptly and bewilderingly as it had begun 5.5 years before. In the afternoon of that snowy Saturday, Casper came staggering home. Blood was soaking through his coat on his right side, and he gasped out what sounded like man stabbed, knife, Hofgarten, give Paris. Gun look quickly. Myron and his wife put him to bed and summoned a doctor. The physician found that Casper had indeed been stabbed just below the rib cage, though the wound didn't appear very serious. Meanwhile, Captain Hickel dashed at Hofgarten, Ansbach Public Park, to find the assailant. The park was deserted and covered with snow, but Hickel did find the purse. The silk money bag Casper had mentioned. Inside the purse, there was a note. Another of those baffling epistles that said nothing in a great many words. And to make matters more complicated, it was penned in mural writing. The only way to read it was to hold it up to a mirror. It said, "Hauser would be able to tell you how I look, whence I came from, and who I am. To spare him that task, I'll tell you myself. I'm from a vocation on the Bavarian border. My name is M.L.O. Contrary to the note's assertion, Casper couldn't tell anybody much of anything. Lying in bed with an ever-growing throng of physicians, police officers, town dignitaries, and clergy around him, he had to repeat over and over the same brief account. He'd gone to the Hofgarten and wanted to meet a man who had contacted him earlier by sending a message through a laborer. The man he described as tall with dark whiskers, wearing a black cloak, approached him with the question, "Are you Casper Hauser?" When Casper nodded, the man handed him the purse and stabbed him. The assailant then ran off. Casper dropped the purse in the snow and struggled home. Well, the entire town mobilized. The search for the attacker extended far out into the surrounding countryside, but not a trace of him could be found. Instead, Captain Hickam revealed a very peculiar fact. In the area where he picked up the purse, he saw only one set of footprints in the snow. Casper's. The evidence rendered the existence of the black-whiskered, black-cloaked stranger somewhat dubious. The gathering around Casper's bedside began to take on the air of a courtroom. Between making him repeat his account, Dr. Meyer, Hickel, and several others urged him to confess and unburden himself. Hauser clung to his story and reasserted his version of the assault. In a voice that was steadily growing weaker, he accused various people, including Lauren Stanhope, of lacking faith in him. Afternoon of December 17th, he went into a coma. That same evening, he died. His last words, "I didn't do it myself." The autopsy revealed that a sharp instrument thrust upward and cut through his diaphragm and penetrated the point of the heart. The postmortem was conducted by three physicians, one of whom gave the opinion the wound could not have been self-inflicted. The other two weren't too sure. However, both the doctors maintained that the blow had been struck by a left-handed person. But remember, Casper was ambidextrous. Hauser's death produced a din. Everybody jumped again into the arena. The air over Ansbach and Nuremberg was thick with charges and countercharges. Printing presses spewed forth an avalanche of pamphlets, books, and even poems about Casper, but everyone connected to him. This tidal wave of paper continued to flow for years. When it had mercifully dried up in Germany, a few belated broadsides were fired in France and England. Literary torrent did nothing to clarify either Hauser's life or his death, but it almost succeeded in washing away the hardcore of fact about this mysterious individual, bearing the real evidence beneath soggy mud piles of spite, guesswork, and fabrication. According to some, Casper had been teleported to Nuremberg from another country. Some authors made him the creature of another planet. He was alleged to be the illegitimate son of virtually the entire Catholic Church hierarchy from the Pope on down. He was supposed to have been the true heir to the Bavarian throne, the bastard child of Lord Stanhope, the brother of the Crown Prince of Prussia, the outcast son of a Jewish girl by a Gentile father. The only contemporary volume to follow a logical pattern of inquiry was that compiled by Anselm von Feuerbach. Bearing the title Example of a Crime Against the Life of the Soul of a Man, the report assumed that every word Casper had said about himself was true. Hauser reasoned the old jurist had to be a legitimate child, because no one would go quite such lengths to hide an illegitimate offspring. Casper Hauser insisted Feuerbach had to be in the line of succession to a very high position, a position sufficiently exalted to induce the exertion of great power to affect his removal and confinement. Since after a certain period his confinement was voluntarily brought to an end, it followed that by that point someone else had occupied the position formerly usurped from Casper. The only position, continued Feuerbach, sufficiently exalted to warrant such manipulation was a royal one. Ergo, Casper Hauser was of royal blood. Having reached the conclusion, Feuerbach cautiously refrained from mentioning which particular crown clan he had in mind. Libel of a crown was no laughing matter in 19th century courts. But the sophisticated could fill in the gap without much difficulty. The only throne in question could be that occupied by the Grand Dukes of Baden. There, all the heirs of the regular line had died in fairly rapid succession, and some under highly suspicious circumstances. This left the road clear for the offspring of a morganatic marriage, which the old Duke Carl Frederick, a widower, had contracted with an attractive 18-year-old commoner by the name of Caroline Geyer. According to the rumor, she had poisoned all the Duke's sons by his previous marriage, and by doing so, had pushed her own progeny closer to the throne. According to this theory, Casper Hauser was the child of the regular line. He'd been spared for sentimental reasons and merely been tucked away in an underground cell to such time as he could be released without endangering the usurper. Then, when his appearance created more fuss than had been anticipated, the ducal clique had him eliminated by a hired assassin. And this surmise had an added factor. Queen Caroline, consort of the reigning King Ludwig of Bavaria, was herself a former princess of the House of Baden. and she could thus be indirectly implicated in the mess. The Grand Ducal administration reacted to the appearance of the book with monumental stupidity. They ordered the book banned in Baden, managed to have it suppressed in Bavaria, and pulled every string within reach to render the ban universal. So, of course, they failed. But they did succeed in giving the volume so much publicity that the booksellers in the rest of Germany couldn't stock the title fast enough to meet the demand. In due course, Feuerbach's opus was translated into English, French, Italian, and Hungarian. The result of the suppression was that the ducal clan of Baden was now widely accused of having poisoned old Feuerbach as well. Amid the general uproar, a few contemporaries got around to casting a cool eye over Feuerbach's conclusions. Had they done so, they would have noticed that the entire structure of Feuerbach's thesis rested upon a very dubious premise. These premises were the conflicts inherent in Caspar Hauser's own story. In compiling his records, Feuerbach, while carefully noting every word of Caspar's story, had apparently ignored the testimony of the earliest witness of the affair. The cobbler Weichmann, for instance, related that after depositing the boy at the Newgate guardroom on his arrival in Nuremberg, he left him to find his own way to Captain Weissen's, which, after being given verbal directions, Caspar successfully did. But assuming that, according to his story, he had never been in a town before and his entire knowledge of language supposedly stemmed from a few phrases taught him by his jailer, how was this possible? In the original description given of him by the policeman, Wurst and Hattel, said to have had a gesund Gesichtsfarbe, a healthy complexion. But anyone locked in a lightless room for 16 or so years would have had the coloring of a corpse. Convicts became sickly pale within a couple of years in spite of daily outdoor exercise as part of their routine. The same police officers also noted the soles of his feet were badly blistered and he found walking both difficult and painful. If, however, he had been confined to a prone position since infancy, he would have found walking not merely difficult, but impossible, and the crippling vitamin deficiency of living solely on blood and water would have left him with barely enough strength to survive, let alone to walk around. So Hauser's original story was open to rather more than considerable doubt. We've got Captain Hickel's testimony seeing only Hauser's own footprints at the scene of an alleged attack. Now, this leaves us with the question of whether Caspar might have inflicted the death blow on himself, and why would he have done that? Being ambidextrous, as I pointed out earlier, he could have found it easy to give himself a left-handed stab, but you got to wonder why. Excuse me. Every person who knew him agreed that Caspar thrives on attention and would produce some new startling tidbit the moment the limelight threatened to veer to some other direction. After his move to Ansbach, he was decidedly out of the spotlight. Bearing a fresh sensation, he would little hope of regaining the stage. But a murderous assault on a person did create such a sensation. So the question became, did he instigate the attack himself? In jabbing a knife into his side, Caspar could have intended a reasonably slight wound. It was a cold day, and his thrust had to pierce a thick overcoat, jacket, shirt, and undershirt. Such a blow required considerable force. He wasn't wearing gloves, which meant his hands were cold and therefore probably clumsy. He could easily misgauge the power of that upward jerk. But even if we accept this rationale, it does leave several points to be considered. What, for instance, happened to the knife Caspar used? No weapon of any sort was found either in the park or en route to the house. Though a dagger is allegedly discovered after the snow had melted, there's no proof that it was the dagger that inflicted the wound. And if Caspar was really an imposter, he was surely the strangest ever recorded. He gained nothing from his fraud except a kind of livelihood and a great deal of notoriety. In return, he had to act a fantastically difficult role year after year, observed by a partially hostile audience with nothing more enticing to view than the prospect of further years of play acting. Well, by now, the mystery of Caspar Hauser had become merely an intellectual exercise, like an unsolved crossword puzzle in a newspaper that is slowly crumbling with age. But the inscription on the stone that marks his grave holds as true today as on the morning of his burial. Here lies the riddle of our time. His birth was unknown, his death mysterious. Who was Caspar Hauser? Well, there are many strange stories that come to us through history. You know, there's a huge qualitative difference between the astonishing and the inexplicable, between the marvelous and the miraculous. When Roger Bannister ran a mile in under 4 minutes, his remarkable athletic feat astounded the sports world. But it's quite possible that at some point in time, some unborn athlete may sprint a mile in 3 minutes or even 2 minutes. Should this occur, it'd be astonishing, though in no way inexplicable. The achievement would be based mainly on the accentuation of known and normal human powers. But the matter becomes a little more perplexing when we deal with intellectual rather than physical faculties. Wolfgang Mozart played the harpsichord at the age of 3. Minuet at 5 and composed a complete, technically valid symphony when he was 8. Still in his teens, he traveled to Rome to listen to the rendition of Gregorio Allegri's Miserere by the papal choir. This was a special piece of sacred music by which the only existing score lay in the vaults of the Vatican. The Pope had forbidden the performance of this particular composition anywhere except in Rome, and then only during Holy Week. When Mozart heard the Miserere but once, he sat down and transcribed the entire lengthy and complex contraptual score from memory. The Pope was so staggered by this feat that he forgave the boy's breach of the ban and presented the youngster with the Order of the Golden Spur. Now, Mozart may have been the most remarkable genius in musical history, but his achievement stemmed entirely from faculties which, to a certain degree, are present in all of us. His powers, however astonishing, are understandable. Same estimate has to be given to the man from Alabama, Tom Wiggins, who during the 1880s toured America and Europe with a piano act and dumbfounded musicologist. He'd been totally blind from birth, could neither read Braille nor add the simplest sums, had the vocabulary and the expression range of a 6-year-old. He'd never seen a keyboard. But this prodigy was able to duplicate any given melody after hearing it once or at the most twice. Now, this power not only applied to simple songs, but to the most intricate fugues and concertos. His skill went beyond the mere repetition of notes. After listening to the performance of a piano virtuoso, Wiggins could imitate the artist's personal style. He could follow subtle shades of expression. He could exactly imitate the artist's manner of handling cadenzas. Wiggins, the son of a plantation slave girl, had never been given a piano lesson. He never expressed deep interest in music as such. He simply seemed capable of storing every note he heard in his brain and finding those notes on an invisible keyboard and reproducing the music in the exact form in which he heard it. He copied amateurs playing just as precisely as he duplicated excellence, and he gave no indication of being aware of any difference. Now, we don't have any name for this particular form of genius. The same fantastic auditory memory has been more recently come to notice from a blind, spastic English boy by the name of Geoffrey Janet, a resident of the London suburb of Ilford, who was born without eyesight, without the use of his legs. Confined to a wheelchair, he spent most of his time listening to the radio and television programs. Then in 1960, he gave a series of memory demonstrations to newspaper men and medical boards that were barely credible. He could repeat, word by word and line by line, every feature that had been broadcast over the preceding 3 or 4 days. He included news bulletins, weather reports, documentaries, church sermons, full-length dramas, and comedy acts. He even reproduced the snatches of squeaky dialogue that accompanied TV cartoons he couldn't see. He knew the exact hour each item had been on the air and its precise length and time and the commercials, if any, that proceeded to follow each program. Oddly, every generation seems to produce such a freak genius of one sort or another. 1934, the Polish government hired Dr. Salo Finkelstein to Replaced 40 trained men and 40 calculating machines in its Treasury Department. Finkelstein was able to perform like an electronic computer. Given a number like 3,108, he could within seconds reduce that number to the square of 52 to the second power, 16 to the second power, 12 to the second power, and 2 to the second power. Calculation would take a mathematician at least 4 minutes to work out on paper. Despite the wonder they aroused, no one credited the musical genius or the musical mimic or the memory whiz or the prodigy mathematician with anything but natural powers. Among those of unusual talent, the person who achieved the greatest international fame undoubtedly was Eric Weiss of Appleton, Wisconsin, known all over the world as Harry Houdini. During a quarter of a century, Houdini baffled millions of people and scores of scientists as well. He was billed as the Wizard of Wisconsin. America's homegrown Merlin was so far beyond the scope of a stage magician that a large segment of the population considered some of his feats to be supernatural. Protest as he would, some of the psychic glue stuck to his magician's cloak and could not be reasoned away, and the occasional odd incidents increased its adhesive qualities. Before he reached world renown, Houdini went to London armed with a batch of certificates that had been signed by police chiefs of a number of American small towns. These documents attested to his prowess as an escape artist. The magician presented these credentials to Dundas Slater, manager of the celebrated Alhambra Theater. He remained noticeably unimpressed. After much discussion, Slater said to Houdini, "I'll make you a proposition. If you can get out of a pair of genuine Scotland Yard handcuffs, I'll sign you." Houdini agreed. Together they went to London's renowned police headquarters where Superintendent Melville listened to the request with much amusement. Without further ado, Melville produced a set of regular derbies, pulled the American's arms around a pillar and snapped on the bracelets and walked to the door. Over his shoulder, he said, "I'll be back for you in a couple of hours, old boy." Well, before he got to the door, Houdini said, "Wait a minute, I'll come with you." There was a faint click and a clatter, and Houdini stooped to pick up the steel cuffs that had dropped to the floor. Then he handed them back to the dumbfounded official, saying, "You forgot your handcuffs, sir." Houdini pulled the same trick dozens of times in the United States, only to have the stunt nullified to a large extent by the belief of an appreciable number of cynics and skeptics alleged the cops were in on it. The Scotland Yard, now that was a different kettle of fish. The British would sooner have assumed Houdini to be in cahoots with the king than with Scotland Yard. Every London newspaper ran the story, splashing Houdini's self-styled title, "The Handcuff King," under his picture. For months after that, Houdini packed the Alhambra. When he departed for Germany, he left behind a city of fanatical fans. And this was just the start of his career. Houdini's real triumphs began across the channel. Paradoxically, the rigid controls imposed on the German stage by the hawk-eyed and indefatigable Polizei worked entirely in his favor. In the Kaiser's realm, the authorities made sure that all vaudeville performers lived up to their claims. Cannonballs were checked for weight, balancing utensils were checked for hidden wires, and ropes and chains were checked for strength. To save German police regulations, save Houdini the trouble of having to prove the quality of his bonds. The same type of pettifogging ordinances took care of his publicity, too. The American had worked out a new stunt for the occasion. He was to be handcuffed and pushed into a river or lake. He declared he'd free himself underwater and come to the surface waiting to the discarded chains. That was fantastic. Except that in every German city, it was forbidden to push anybody into the water, handcuffed or otherwise. Well, the band didn't stop the performance, but it ensured that in each town he visited, he was holding it before a magistrate, solemnly fined one mark, and subsequently featured in the local press, what otherwise would have ignored his stunt. The same procedure was enacted in 11 different towns, Houdini handing over one mark on each case and raking in 1,000 times that amount in free advertising. The sole variation occurred in Dresden, where the fine was doubled, one mark being for being pushed into a pond, another for having stepped on the surrounding lawn. Meanwhile, Houdini's stage performances left his audience gasping. And this in spite of the fact he'd not yet developed his really spectacular feats that he showed in his later career. His success was largely due to the absolute faith of the Germans in their efficiency and then the efficiency of their restraining equipment and their profound shock at seeing those iron bonds and chains treated as if they were pieces of string. In Essen, engineers at the Krupp Works devised a special set of chains for his benefit. Equipped with a brand new triple lock, the two inventors in person fastened the chains on Houdini's wrist. All Germans were agreed that no man who ever lived could break those all-powerful bonds. 3.5 minutes later, timed by a stopwatch, Houdini handed the open cuffs back to their inventors with a polite Dankeschön. In Cologne, the performance was so astounding that it seemed utterly beyond belief, so much so that a member of the local constabulary named Werner Graf was minded to insert a notice in the local press branding Houdini as a charlatan, and his entire act as unmitigated and brazen fraud. The magician brought suit against the police officer for libel and joined in the action the entire Cologne police force for good measure. When he appeared before the lower court, he informed the judge he was prepared to substantiate on the spot any and every claim made in his publicity posters. Accordingly, the judge invited the defendants to do their damnedest, and the police force went to work with a vengeance. They loaded Houdini with chains around his wrists, his elbows, his ankles, even around his neck. Fired up by the quite erroneous belief that the more metal the magician was weighed with, the harder it would be for him to get away. If the jurors had inspected a dramatic struggle, they were destined to be disappointed. All they saw were a few twists of Houdini's body, a jerking of his arms and legs too fast to be followed. They saw nary a lock open, but merely heard clicks, followed by the rattling of chains dropping on the polished courtroom floor. The entire procedure took less than 2 minutes. Houdini stood up free, and the verdict was but a formality at that point. Graf and Company appealed the case to the higher court. Before that tribunal, the defendants produced a contraption especially made for the occasion. It was a lock, they explained, it couldn't even be opened with its own key once the lock had been snapped shut. Houdini asked permission to retire to a prisoner cell in the basement. A few minutes later, he emerged from the cell with the open lock dangling jauntily from his index finger. Once again, verdict for Houdini. The Cologne police, nothing but not persevering, felt they hadn't yet made big enough fools of themselves. They dragged the case to the Prussian Supreme Court. This time they introduced a new test. Houdini, their plea now ran, had claimed to be able to open safes as well as locks, yet he hadn't opened a single safe in Germany. Ergo, he had not substantiated his claims. Red-robed, white-bearded judge gravely considered his defense, then he announced, "I think we can test this matter immediately. Happened to have a very powerful strongbox in my chamber, so if Herr Houdini would oblige us." Though the defendants didn't realize it, at that moment they had the plaintiff very worried indeed. Houdini could handle any American safe, but he had never had experience with a German safe. But there was no backing out for him now. He merely asked permission to be left alone with the strongbox, hoping to discover its secret. The judge led him into his chambers and withdrew. Houdini stood facing the massive steel cube whose workings he knew were quite different from the transatlantic breed. Tentatively, he tried the handle, and the door swung open. The judge had forgotten to lock it. Just for drama, he waited a few minutes before strolling back into the court, ostensibly wiping his fingers with his handkerchief. There was no appeal from this final verdict, which forced the Cologne police to eat a humble pie on the front page of 41 German dailies, an act of mastication that echoed far beyond the borders of the fatherland. Following day, Houdini was the most famous, most popular performer on the European stage. From an average income of $75 a week, his salary skyrocketed to tenfold that amount. When he returned to the United States, the great Houdini legend was beginning to take shape. The alleged endowment of occult powers later became the bane of his life. An artist of outsized vanity, Houdini took inordinate pride in his physical skill and courage and seethed with rage whenever his achievements were attributed to anything else, because he only claimed to be a magician, nothing more. Nevertheless, some of his stunts seemed quite miraculous. His most famous tour de force was performed under the title of The Man Who Walks Through Walls. For this act, a wall was erected on stage, actually built in front of the audience with brick and mortar by volunteer bricklayers from a local union. The wall rose sideways into the auditorium so the audience could see both sides. Built on top of a carpet, the construction was inspected by a committee of prominent citizens. The solid carpet that covered the floor ruled out the use of a trap door. The end of the wall stood flush against it, at right angles to a solid metal sheet that was inspected by the committee. After the wall was built, the committee positioned itself on one side of the wall, Houdini on the other side. Folding screens were then set up, shielding the magician and the wall from observation. Houdini obviously standing near one of the walls and obviously within the screens, waved his hands above one of the screens, calling out to the audience, "Here I am," and then his hands disappeared as his voice rang out, "Here I go." A moment later, his hands appeared again, but now they were above the screen on the other side of the wall. Screens were removed, and there was Houdini. He had passed through the wall. Again, the committee examined the wall, the carpet, and the metal sheet. All were intact. How did he do it? Well, among the multitudes who found the trick convincing proof of Houdini's paranormal capabilities was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. While the creator Sherlock Holmes was an inspired novelist, he was quite gullible when it came to psychic matters. Sir Arthur drove the magician frantic by proclaiming in print that Houdini knew materialized himself and that the magician was waved through the bricks in ghost-like fashion. Poor Houdini. Couldn't afford to reveal the secret of his top act, so a secret it remained until his death when his notebooks revealed the ruse. There was a large trap door underneath the carpet. The moment the screens were put up, the trap door was swung open. When the trap door opened, the carpet under the wall sagged ever so slightly even a child couldn't have squirmed through the resultant space, but Houdini could. When he wiggled through, the trap door swung shut, leaving the carpet as solid-looking and as tight as it had been before. All tricks. Well, we come to the end of another show, and we'll be back on Monday when we'll talk about more unsolved mysteries. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.